Welcome back to the program. Here in the Bay Area, particularly Silicon Valley and San Francisco, we have seen one of the greatest concentrations of business startups the world has ever known. Aside from very smart young people working for them, what else do they have in common? Why is it that some succeed beyond all expectations and others fade away? Why do we see so many serial entrepreneurs, people without MBAs, that are able to take an idea, build a business, scale it, and deliver remarkable results? What's the secret sauce? Our guest today, David Kidder, is one of those serial entrepreneurs. But he also set about to find out what makes entrepreneurs tick. What are the startup secrets? He's put them all together in the Startup Playbook. David Kidder is an entrepreneur with a wide range of marketing and technology expertise. Most recently, he served as the co-founder and CEO of Clickable. Prior to that, he co-founded Smart Ray Network. He's a graduate of Rochester Institute of Technology. It is my pleasure to welcome David Kidder here to talk about the Startup Playbook. Secrets of the fastest growing startups from their founding entrepreneurs. David Kidder, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. I'm a pleasure to be here.
Delight to have you. What made you think, first of all, that you could find kind of a set of rules, a playbook, as you call it, that in fact so many entrepreneurs could buy into, could really define what it is that makes them successful?
I wasn't sure, actually, to be honest with you. It was more about trying to understand, discover the difference, was it really something about practice, was it whether they thought, or is it more ideological and what they kind of bet their life on? And so I was really in a personal journey after building, you know, four companies over the last 18 years. You want to know. It's like you're living out your little movie, and if you don't watch, you know, 50 movies, you don't really understand the plots and what's successful and not successful in someone's journey. It's the advantage that an investor has over an entrepreneur, so that they get a chance to just to see the lives of the whole movie, so to speak, of these startups.
And one of the principal ideas that you found in all of this, and maybe one of the first rules, is that the successful entrepreneurs really knew themselves. They really understood what it is that they could bring to the party.
Yeah, I mean, this is the main thing that I drew from the experience, is that most of the entrepreneurs were drawing from their innate gifts. They were following the rabbit hole, a deep curiosity or a problem that they just were obsessed with solving. So they weren't really chasing white space. It wasn't like they were figuring out, like, how big could this get or how much money could this be. It was really focused on that innate area of interest that defined them and defined the purpose of their work.
In many ways, it sounds simple to align one's talent with what one wants to do, but it's not so simple.
It's actually incredibly complex and also takes an insane amount of courage, because you have to let go of optionality. It's about doing fewer things and having fewer chances of success, because you have limited time and energy and resources and money very often, and you have to bet it all on a single thesis very often that you are innately gifted to go solve. If you chase white space, or you move out, or you create options, it either dilutes the focus or dilutes the resources where the answer might never come.
And yet, as you found out in talking to so many of these people, the seduction is really to focus on many things.
It is. I've made that personal mistake. I've done that mistake many times, which is taking opportunity or taking optionality that actually ends up splitting the mind of the company. I'll never do those things again. But one area of learning is to actually do less and focus more on a single set of problems.
Talk a little bit about that and some of the examples that you outlined in the Startup Playbook, some of the stories that you heard, where that seduction of multiple focus has been deadly.
You know, I there's a lot of examples where someone chose not to do something because of that seduction, which are equally as good. So, for instance, the story of LinkedIn, which started just slightly before Facebook, and Reid Hoffman started that in part of the kind of PayPal mafia group of companies in that area. And at one moment, the companies were in lockstep, growing very similar. And then Facebook introduced the news feed and pictures, and it went from, you know, 10 million users to 100 million in a matter of months. And yet they stayed focused on the professional social network area, and they continued to just climb and build the company very steadily. So ultimately, they're kind of long-term greedy. A lot of these companies, because they're so disciplined in their focus, they might have to give up optionality that would otherwise, you know, potentially grow the company very fast, but also in the wrong direction. And so those things are seductive, but they're often, they have to be, the answer has to be no.
And what's interesting is that you found that in many cases it's driven by fear, that it's not just the seduction, it's fear that leads to chasing many things.
Yeah, or what I like to call the sin of comparison. There are things that, that it's just things that help define the company. If you listen to the marketplace too much and you follow other people's stories more than your own, or just potentially ignoring marketplace, you can fall in the trap of chasing other people's press releases or strategy when ultimately you have to build your own company. You have to follow your own path no matter where it takes you.
The danger in that also, as you talk about, is wishful thinking and what happens when there's too much optimism.
Yes, pathological optimism is a great word and a powerful tool. You have to be a little bit insane or a little bit ideologically focused on absurd outcomes to do it. But I think that, you know, the job of a founder very often is to set an incredible vision, hire great talent, and make sure you never run out of money, whether that means organic growth or raising capital. And once you do those three things and you think you've done a good job, you can sort of sit back and let the company live out. And the reality is that you're crossing your fingers. And that's super dangerous because if this is the wishful thinking thing. And it actually comes from a conversation with Elon Musk, which is, you know, never engage in wishful thinking. You can be optimistic, but I think it's really important to be your own biggest critic, to be cynical in some areas until it's true. It's not true. We're not going to not hope that it works out. You really have to roll up your sleeves and be certain that you are driving the company towards the right answers.
The other part of it is in defining what the mission of the company is, defining that one big idea.
Yes. There's the common words, you know, vision, mission, and principles. I like the words purpose, work, and beliefs. They're very similar, but they're actually more simple in the sense that, you know, the purpose of this business is to blank. In the case of Apple, it's the purpose of the business is to make great products. They didn't say technology products or internet products. It's just make great products. It's very simple. The work is actually what you do to produce that purpose outcome. It's, you know, our work, our effort is focused on, you know, utilizing great technology to, you know, create new user experiences that, you know, positively impact the world, whatever that is. But the work actually goes towards living out that purpose. And then the beliefs, which, i.e. our values, are the, you know, four or five or six things that always are true. It's the things that, it's how we treat each other, it's how we treat the marketplaces, it's what are our highest priorities, whether it be simplicity or innovation or invention, sense of ownership, the things that are the biggest gears that produce the work, that produce and live out the purpose.
Talk about the balance, though, between coming up with that big idea that defines something that people need versus something that might be more elective or something that you have to convince people that they need.
Well, there's a simple way to describe that, and I like to say, you know, build painkillers and not vitamins. A lot of VCs say that. It's not a new idea, but it's a good way to kind of it's a lens to view the world through. You know, ultimately, you got to be solving someone's chronic pain in a very beautiful and elegant way. And so it's a way to kind of distill, you know, who is my customer? What's the value I'm creating? How long is that value created for? So it's one thing to cure cancer, but after someone's cured cancer, they don't need you anymore. It's another thing to solve, you know, a migraine or a chronic pain. You want to solve chronic pain, whether it be consumer or business. You got to focus on big markets that are in pain and have a great, great drug.
What about the argument that we've heard from many entrepreneurs that, in fact, people don't know what they want, they have to be told? How does that fit into that bigger equation?
Well, this is the genius of Steve Jobs is, you know, the customer doesn't know what they really want until they see it. There's a lot of truth to that, yes. Some marketplaces, like the enterprise marketplace, are sort of built backwards. They're feature-driven. There are other marketplaces that are pure invention or they're, you know, reimagination. They wouldn't, you know, those are typically marketplaces that, you know, where a consumer really doesn't know the future or doesn't know what the future looks like. And very often entrepreneurs can kind of bring the future forward to a customer and say, look at this, you know, extraordinary disruptive value. But very often the form that takes has to be almost magical. It has to do something that isn't incrementally better, but it's compounding. It needs to be 10 times better very often to have that type of impact for a customer to switch and experience that magic.
And, of course, for the entrepreneur, unless it is something that's 10 times better or significantly better, there's an argument as to why it's worth doing in the first place.
Well, this goes back to the heart of it, is that entrepreneurship is an irrational decision, right? No one would go through the amount of pain and energy it takes to build a company and how stupidly hard it is if they didn't have an irrational belief that the world needed their invention. And so that in itself is why you do it. It's not about the money. It's not about often the customer. It's about the fact that you were created to innately create this one product or this one service, which is why, you know, going outside of those strengths typically doesn't have the type of horsepower energy that's required to build something that's great.
Are these ideas that you've looked at and that many of these entrepreneurs have shared with you, are these universal? Have they always been true with respect to entrepreneurs building companies? Or is there something innately unique to the technology world, for example?
I don't think so. I don't think that, in the book as well, we have people like the founder of Spanx and Honest Tea and Seventh Generation and, you know, iRobot. So there's nonprofits as well, like Charity Water and Acumen Fund. And, you know, it's like there is quite a bit of diversity there. I didn't find a lot of differences between the type of sectors that people were building in and the type of energy and focus it took. So I think the ideas are universal, but they're also very personal. I mean, the things that I drew from the book are going to be different than what you might. My thesis that I walked away with was just because of the immersion and potentially because of the things that I was filling in that were own personal weaknesses. But everyone, no entrepreneur is perfect, and this type of content, this type of learning can potentially build their own playbook out of it. That's the hope.
And, of course, the one thing, though, that is absolutely universal, and you've mentioned this a couple of times, is how hard this is to do, and I think people underestimate that.
It's extremely hard. They see all the fantastic, you know, glorious things that come out of it, but they forget how difficult it is to do it. I mean, you know, they always say that positive news or positive press, you know, covers of magazine comes in pairs, right? You're a hero, and the next one you're an idiot. So you're never really as good as you think you are. You're never really as bad as you think you are. I mean, even recently, if you look at Reed Hastings from Netflix, mm-hmm. You know, he's 2011 Fortune's Businessman of the Year, and for the last 2 years, he's been filleted in the marketplace for his vision and where he's taking the company. But it's the same brilliant, successful guy, and he is brilliant, successful. And last week, he crushed his numbers, and he's back. So, I mean, it's a journey, and it's if you listen to all the outside markers and it affects your esteem, you're in big trouble. You need to be committed to the journey of who you're becoming in all of this to have enough kind of sea legs to pull it off. It takes an incredible amount of courage.
Talk a little bit about timing, because that comes up over and over again in so many of the people that you talk to in terms of when something hits the marketplace.
Your questions are great, by the way, so I appreciate. I can totally tell you're prepared, so thank you. You're actually hitting on something that's incredibly important, which is luck, right? What's the role of luck in these extraordinary outcomes? And I would tell you that it's very, very significant. 50, 60, up to 70% of often the outcomes of these companies is just because of timing. Part of that can be because these entrepreneurs are so good instinctually of good timing. They are futurists in a way, so that's also true. And the other part is that it has nothing to do with them. You know, it's very often that they just happen to be the right place at the right time, and their vision was rewarded economically, and it was extraordinary. You hear a lot of stories, and I did in the totally immersion experience I had, where they said, you know, if we didn't sell the company for, you know, $2 billion, 6 months later, we'd be out of business. And that happens too. So what I'd say is that in building companies, you're don't swing for home runs. You can have a big vision and execute, but your expectation should be that I'm building a single or a double. A single is kind of a great, building an amazing, great company that creates lots of economic or customer oxygen. a double B, we create an incredible amount of oxygen. And the rest is kind of up to the marketplace. It's things that you don't control. But you have to be prepared for it. You have to work your tail off. And, you know, a lot of it's, 30-40% of it's in your control. The rest is just good fortune.
But as you talk about, if you're going to go through all of this pain and everything that we've been discussing so far, pick something that you're going to build value with. It's going to be almost a monopoly for a while.
Yes, I mean, this is a very distinctive learning that I had from the experience, was that a lot of the entrepreneurs are monopolists. They think from day one, you know, it's not that they want, 1% of a marketplace, they want 99% of it. They want everything. And they design their product and how they deploy their resources to have that outcome be true. So they want to put kind of hooks and barbs and electrify them in their customers so they never leave. And that's both implicit and explicit in how they build the company. They're very good natured and they're high trust, authentic people, but they're also designing something to win it all.
The other thing is that you never can let up. I mean, that's another aspect of this that comes across over and over again, that even when you think your company has taken off, there's still a lot of danger out there.
Yes. I mean, there's always inherent risks in every marketplace. This is why economic oxygen matters so long, is that you have to have, companies don't die, so to speak. They run out of money is another famous axiom. So having the legs, so to speak, to last can often outlast market circumstances as well can give you enough time to create an extraordinary product or value that someone just can't live without. I remember reading this article recently where they said if your customers aren't gouging their eyes out because they can't live without you, you haven't created the value it takes to sustain a great startup.
David Kidder, his book is The Startup Playbook, Secrets of the Fastest Growing Startups from Their Founding Entrepreneurs. David, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
I'm very grateful for the opportunity, so thank you so much.
Thank you.